One of the biggest things that we are committed to is to ensure that we are gearing towards the goal of let's live a long life, and that is Shana Danigligo Us At Nel Teto.
It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Food and social change are together more than ever. And somebody that's right in the middle of that is Denisa Livingston. Denisa, you've got so many things I can call you from what I've heard you introduced already. But you're a social kind of entrepreneur. You are somebody involved in justice. You live in New Mexico. You've been involved and understand a lot of the whole community of the First Nations. When someone meets you and say, okay, when you're back in New Mexico doing what you do, what exactly is that?
So first and foremost, thank you for having me on this podcast. And Yat'e, which is the greeting in Diné, meaning all is well, all is whole, all is it is beautiful.
Oh, wait, you're going to have to say that again then. So the language is, you say it's Diné. It's spelled like dine.
Right, with but it's pronounced high E at the end.
Diné. Diné. Mm-hmm. So that language... Say that again in Diné.
Yat'e, which is the greeting that we all greet one another with.
How about live long and healthy? What does that mean?
So one of the biggest things that we are committed to is to ensure that we are gearing towards the goal of let's live a long life, and that is Shana Danigligo Us At Nel Teto.
How did you learn your own language? I mean, it's I'm sure you inherited, but there was a time where this language was almost lost, wasn't it?
And it was a oral tradition, and just recently has been written, but most of it has been passed on to me through my family, and especially my parents and my grandmother. But I'm still learning. It is something that is an ever-evolving lesson for me that, you know, going into the work that I'm doing is learning, you know, the language, and also how do we use our language, you know, to revive and restore and provide healing for our people. So it's very complex, but I'm still learning. We're using our language to not only capture our audience of our own people to hear about the suffering and the struggle of the epidemic of diabetes that we are facing, but also issues of uranium contamination and other injustices and work that we've been leading and creating change for our communities to be living in a healthful way. And so our language is something that unites us with our history and our past and also our future. So it's something that it's an ever-evolving practice and tradition.
So what part of New Mexico?
In the Four Corners area.
Okay, so you're Utah, Arizona, Colorado, and New Mexico.
As you hear my grandmother speak, who's almost 90 years old, she will share her stories of her grandmother and, you know, and the stories that were passed on to her, and also her experience. And so it definitely is a couple hundred years back, and it is something, you know, that I've yet to explore.
Did I hear you right that sometimes people refer to those really, really early years as hunter-gatherers, but it doesn't really fit?
There are a lot of different stories depending on which part of the Navajo Nation, of course, our ancestral land, that are variations of geography, and whether it's mountainous, whether it's dry land, it's desert. And so the practices for our people, you know, it varied. And so, you know, from my father's territory, you know, it's very mountainous, and what they did, and the pine nuts that I've brought here from the pinyon pine are some of the, you know, the harvesting that they did. And then from where my mother comes from, it was the dryland farming. And so, you know, variations of practices of farming and harvesting, but also hunting too, As we, you know, in areas we have deer and elk, and also fishing. And so, fishing and gaming, that's something that has been practiced, you know, for years, but also the adaptation of the Navajo Churro lamb, the Navajo Churro sheep,
that has C-H-U-R-R-O.
That's right. And so that is something, you know, that has been brought into, introduced into our culture, and has been, a part of our survival. And so really it's been an evolution of different practices, but now, you know, restoring those traditions and exploring those traditions of even the roots and the wild plants and the herbs, you know, of using them and drying them and harvesting them and processing them so that we can use them as food or either medicine. So different variations.
Now, the Churro sheep, if I'm not mistaken, may have been come over from the Spanish.
That's right.
500, 600 years ago or something like that. And then they also also harvest the wool, but it's not typical wool. It's wools that are used for primarily rugs and some other things, but not typical clothing, though, from the Churro sheep.
Textiles, but more of... rugs, like you said, and now creating and growing a generation of fiber artists, and exploring ways of using that wool. But it's a very distinct type of wool that is very strong and sturdy, and finding now uses of how do we use this wool is an exploration for us too.
You must have come to a conclusion that you were going to engage yourself in social justice issues. I'm curious when and how the light bulb went off, Denisa says, okay, this is the direction for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the biggest compliment right now is for my grandmother and my mother, who have set the path before me. And I speak about this is that it's not something that I chose, that it is something that we grow into, as Diné women, and finding our purpose and finding, really what is our calling, and finding that purpose is that looking back at what our parents and our grandparents have been through and what their struggles were, and also, how that they have survived and have been resilient is something, you know, I've yet to share many stories about my grandfather who died from direct contamination of uranium, and our family fighting, you know, and advocating for justice to address the uranium contamination, and also addressing the victims of what we've been through is certainly critical to my work and growing up. Knowing that advocacy, knowing that we have a voice, and knowing that these are issues that we need to address as a family, as a community, was not something that, you know, as an individual that I chose, like, this is social justice, this is the area I'm going to go into. It has been as a community that we've been able to move together. And to this day, now addressing the lack of healthy food access, addressing the diabetes epidemic, and also addressing junk food or junk as food, like I said, that, you know, this Ch'ion Bajol, Ch'ion meaning food, and Bajol meaning the unhealthy food, the processed food, the prison food, the oppressive food, the fast casual food, all of that food that has never been a part of our diet, knowing that social justice and food justice and social change is going to come through the ways of addressing Ch'ion Bajol. And this is something that has been also a reaction to our people, Diné people who are sent to the camp. And I get chills, you know, talking about this every time that, you know, we were sent to a concentration camp by the U.S. government, and everything removed and taken from us. And 150 years ago, our people signed the Treaty of 1868 and were allowed to return back to Navajo land after trekking from Navajo land to Bosque Redondo, which is southern New Mexico, and spent years at the concentration camp, but everything removed and taken from them, returned with rations of now sugar, salt, and flour, items that were made with these ingredients, and also canned foods. And so addressing the struggles and addressing what my parents have gone through with them being in boarding schools, also because and as a reaction to the signed treaty that our ancestors and our grandparents were also a part of the treaty, is that they were to attend boarding schools and attend schools and receive an education. That now my parents went to the boarding schools that also, you know, has caused a lot of trauma. And in addressing that, you know, all from these different aspects of experience and history, and especially now, you know, the repercussions of it, and also the injustices have been caused by it. And so together, all of these experiences, all of the history, and as a community, as a nation, as the Dene Nation, as the Navajo Nation, we are addressing who we are so that we can go forward and create a culture, and also create a society, and create a future that we know that our future generations will at least have an opportunity to live a healthy, wholesome life. So all of these experiences of addressing social justice or stepping into it has been an accumulation of what my ancestors went through.
How long did that period last of being in the concentration type camps that they were shipped off to for what? How long?
It was several years. And of course, you know, there were those that didn't make it there on the way. There were those that had spent time there who also escaped. So, you know, depending on, you know, the amount of years that that our people, you know, survived through that, was several years. And it did, you know, I mean, our people were removed from everything and introduced to a diet that never existed in their diet ever. And to this day, 150 years later, we're still addressing the effects of the processed food.
Today, what's called the Navajo Nation is like bigger than many states. It's I don't know how many millions of acres, but it's a very, very large area.
The state of Virginia.
Okay. And so it's a very, very large area. Now, but the food that's available in that area, the supermarkets and so forth, you tend to have an awful lot of junk food. And it's much more affordable, right, than buying fruits and vegetables
staples.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, staples.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And just today, someone had approached me and said, Denisa, your reference of being a 99% quote-unquote food desert, you know, and having an unhealthy food tax, that primarily means that you're taxing almost everything if it is a 99% inventory of unhealthy foods. Yes, there's 1% access to healthy food, and it's definitely fast, cheap, and easy. Yep. And these are the values we're addressing, is that we don't want to raise a generation of our community members being fast, cheap, and easy.
Right.
And having a diet that reflects that. And, you know, and this is something that 1% access to healthy food is very critical, and it is an emergency, because we have our community members who are suffering and dying every day from diabetes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and how are we, you know, addressing that as a nation as well? Because this is not only an issue on the Navajo Nation in Indian country. It's something that, of course, in the United States, of course, in many areas across the world, that now we're facing these processed food industries.
Well, you know what's unique about what you're in the middle of is that there's a lot of people that have recognized this crisis, and they're addressing it with education, telling people, which I think most people know that it'd be better if they, you know, broccoli rather than Doritos. But still, I mean, it's a lot of education that they're trying to address it. You actually have a tax on unhealthy food.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that. How does that work?
So in 2014, we have been for several years previously been leading an initiative to address the junk food, unhealthy foods, the Cheon Bajol inventory on our land. And in 2014, after many years of trial and error and introducing, and also our bill, our legislation had been vetoed. We went back to override the veto of our Navajo Nation president, and also reintroduced again one more time. And finally, the Healthy Dene Nation Act out of all of that was passed. And it's a 2% tax in additional to the sales tax, which was previously 5% and now 6% in most areas across Navajo. And this 2% tax is a tax on unhealthy foods, processed foods. And so this is something too that we were addressing, that junk food had never been a part of our diet, that we also had to create the terminology of Jian Bajol, the unhealthy food, but also recognizing that these foods were very prevalent and also widely available, very cheap in our communities. And so this is a sales tax that applies to all retail areas across Navajo, whether that's in the grocery stores, convenience stores, the restaurants, and even the casinos that we have, and also even in the pawn shops where they're selling chips, soda, and candy. And so this is a 2% friendly awareness tax that we've been able to first pass in the U.S. and the first of its kind, still the only kind of initiative when we're talking about a junk food tax or even soda tax. Primarily the focus across the country has been on soda tax, but we've been able to do a wide junk food tax.
So you can do that as a Navajo Nation, and it exists then in whether it's in Utah or Arizona or New Mexico or Colorado, because it is the Navajo Nation. Is this being looked at by any other Native American tribes in other parts of the United States?
Mm-hmm. So although for us it exists in Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, the Navajo Nation, there are now explorations of doing something similar but on a lower scale, maybe just a chip, soda, and candy piece tax of legislation and tax, which is more manageable and it can be implemented much easily than what we've been doing. And so, you know, for us, we're looking at like the donuts, we're looking at the hot dogs that are at the convenience stores, the burritos and the taquitos that you see that are fried and fast and widely available. And so our bill really, I mean, is addressing those energy drinks too, and also those processed coffees that you see of all assortments, and even the sports drinks. And so really what is tax exempt is only water. Other tribes have been trying to explore something similar, right? And even some tribes have approached us to do executive orders to ban tribal funding on soda.
So when this all starts, then how does the government work? So is there like a legislature or something that has to have a bill introduced for the Navajo Nation in this case, and somebody has written up a bill, there are hearings and committees, they're voted on, and perhaps whoever the president or the top leader has the potential to veto, that they could override and things like that. So it's like the typical legislative function.
That's
in that
right.
Extent.
Mm-hmm.
So does that also mean that lobbyists from, you know, Pepsi and all the others that coming in there and telling everybody, coming to the committees and taking them out to dinner and saying, I don't think you ought to be doing this?
Yeah, we definitely had an emotional struggle and also the presence of our own people hired as lobbyists by these multi-billion dollar industries to come and advocate and spread the message that these processed foods are not a cause or not a problem to the diabetes epidemic.
Yeah.
And this is something that we had faced over the years, that one of the critical things was that, you know, one of the companies came and wanted to offer our communities on water filtration systems.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there were, you know, offers of monetary gifts and, you know, and influence that we felt as Diné people, that we we felt that we were all in line to revitalize our culture and our health and our people, and to be on the same page that we want healthy lifestyles, that we want healthy future generations. But yes, there were lobbyists. Yes, there was a lot of opposition, because junk food and unhealthy food, this Gian Bajol is not just a diet. It's Gian Bajol. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And the diet, it is not just a trend. It's an addiction that we knew that we would be taxing somebody's breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And this was the biggest, you know, discussion is that, you know, they were addressing it as a regressive tax. But we, you know, said it's a friendly awareness tax, and that through this quote-unquote regressive tax, that, you know, the benefits are progressive. Yeah. And the health benefits of it are progressive. And so we would counter-argue, and the biggest thing is that instead of calling it the junk food tax, we called it the Healthy Denination Act of 2014. When we started to say the Healthy Denination Act, the Healthy Denination Initiatives, people started to respond more positively. When we were addressing and talking about quote-unquote junk food, people would react and now close up and not want to expose their experience of having diabetes and their struggle of overcoming this addiction. And so it is something that has been now stemmed of, like, not just looking at soda and sugar and salt and flour and chips and candy and all the processed foods that we have. And it is really just now looking at the behavior and looking at, you know, how many years do we have to face this, and where did this where were these foods introduced, and why are we still facing these issues, and why haven't we returned back to regenerative farming, or, you know, raising our own crops and growing our own food and looking forward and really embracing together, despite the lobbyists, that food is medicine. Why aren't we on the same page? And that is something that even to this morning I receive calls that, you know, that this is the conversation that you would think that we would all be, as Diné people, as Indigenous people, that water is life, and so healthy food should be life. Sure. That's what healthy food is. That healthy food is life. But there is a lot of opposition because of greed, because of money, and because of power, that we are in the struggle, and our people are being recruited into that.
One thing I wonder is that beyond the Indigenous communities, we're starting to see millennials in particular that are becoming a lot more engaged in just in general across society. I'm wondering, within the tribe, do you think is part of the issue not just that it's coming to a head of all these health issues, but is there more engagement by younger generation of people that are becoming more effective and speaking up to the politicians and the lobbyists?
It is a very difficult position, as we are a grassroots organization, the Diné Community Advocacy Alliance, that our Navajo Nation government is a replication of the U.S. government. And it's very patriarchal. The system does not encourage our tradition of being a matrilinear matriarchal society, that women can have a voice, that women can lead, and for the younger generations, for people to be stepping into this zone of now being the first time to author legislation, to introduce legislation, and to be involved in this type of work, and to deal with different aspects of the government, whether it's the Office of the Controller, whether it's Division of Community Development, whether it's the Navajo Nation Tax Commission, executive branch, the legislative branch, that our people and our community members are now stepping into roles that they have also never explored. And this is a relationship new on the other side as well, that we are not Navajo Nation government employees, and yet we're trying to advocate and have relationships and build a generation that are guaranteed, but also accepted and welcome into creating change in partnership with the government. Right. And so this is something that we have also been challenged by, and also have suffered through, that our own people many times did not accept us in those areas that, you know, we were questioned about why are we writing, you know, bills? Why are we authoring legislation? And who are we, you know, do we have the expertise? And we are invalidated maybe because we don't have those titles or that we don't have those degrees or expertise that, you know, we are seen as just community members. But the conversation is that now we're bringing to the table is that our community members should not be seen as liabilities, but they should be seen as assets, because now we have an entire generation who are retired that are willing to commit to a cause, that are willing to use their skills, their talent, and their time, and these community currencies that we're able to leverage off of to create this change is something now is a conversation entirely across the world. And so to step into these conversations with leaders and with politicians and also lobbyists that we are criticized and not often supported, and we're stepping to something that has never been explored before. But as a Diné person, we are always told that we are the change, that, you know, we are the generation, that we are the people that have the power, that, you know, our ancestral knowledge, that my grandma, my mother, you know, and my family, you know, have been through this, you know, and not formally, that we have already the knowledge, that we already have the skills and the time and the talent that, you know, that we need and the expertise. And we have a big community that are able to contribute and be a part of a change that has never occurred. But how do we do that in partnership with tribal governments? And so,
well, it's hard. I mean, it's hard work for everybody, but you're making progress and you've done more than most. And there's one other thing I want to get to. Mm-hmm. You opened the door to talking about what's happening worldwide. And I know you're involved in so many other things in the slow food movement globally, but also other indigenous people around the world. Have you been surprised at how much you have in common with as you open up the communications around the world and saying, here you are in New Mexico from the perspective that you have, but that you are discovering other indigenous people. Mm-hmm. Are they on similar journeys that you've had?
They're on very similar journeys, and many times are not recognized as well, and many times are not supported, but at many times are very resilient. And this is something that now that we are engaged together, that we can now have a network and also learn how to support one another and learn from one another, that maybe there are struggles and opportunities that are similar and are parallel, and now we're able to communicate that, you know, we have emails, that we can be on WhatsApp, that we can, you know, Skype and use technology now, that we're not a world away, that we're just like a click away. And so this is something that is now, you know, very empowering for all of us, and especially the youth, the younger generation who want to be a part of the slow food movement and who want to address and explore gastronomy and taste education and learn about other indigenous peoples that are very similar. I was recently in Kenya, and the indigenous people there and the Maasai people, I mean, we have so much in common. And, you know, one of the experiences that I had is that we make a blood sausage, you know, with the stomach lining, and they did the same thing, you know, and it was like, I recognize even this, you know, blood sausage that they were making. They were surprised that I knew what it was. And, you know, and it's like, there's so many different commonalities. And I think the beauty of it is that we are finding each other. It's like we are family that, you know, have been lost, or, you know, that now we're coming back together, and that, you know, we're building this bond and health solidarity, because we know that these processed food industries are coming to our communities and trying to recruit our youth into their leadership. And so, you know, the struggles are the same. There's so much also diversity too that we want to respect and honor. But, you know, how do we learn from one each other? How do we embrace one another and move forward so that we know that we have a sustainable future?
Well, and I'm kind of glad to have you put in a good word for technology in a way, because I'm getting so used to being frustrated with, I think we're too much online. But on the other hand, you're reminding us that peoples around the world are also able to share their stories and communicate with each other, and you're a click away from indigenous people in Nairobi and share stories and make more progress because of it. So that's what we had hoped we'd get out of technology. One final area I just wanted to talk on, and that is when your food is integral to all of this. Are you progressing with the farmer relations that producing the kind of food that you want to see that's made available locally?
So one of the things, you know, as far as like healthful food production is, you know, different challenges come up across Navajo, whether that's water contamination or the lack of knowledge of dry farming or even the opportunities to have gardening classes or instruction. And also, I think one of the biggest challenges, too, is that migration. The youth are moving from the rural areas to the urban areas, but all of these, you know, conversations and the challenges of it are creating now opportunities. And through the unhealthy foods tax, you know, that's able to fund community wellness projects, this tax funds, you know, those greenhouses, funds agricultural projects, funds cooking classes and traditional preservation classes of the food, and also exploring water, clean water initiatives, and also addressing recycling programs. I think now, you know, we are also learning about how to create programs about keeping our youth, you know, locally, that they also are empowered by their own and also willing to stay and learn and also teach and be a mentor, be a mentee, you know, that we together now can create a community. And so food production now is through the Healthy Dene Nation Act. It's been a vehicle to address all of these different areas, whether it's that food production and now the elevation and the growth of more farmers markets coming, ensuring that we're connecting the farmers to the producers and the co-producers, those having those conversations, and also the opportunities of tasting workshops and cooking classes and explorations of, you know, how to navigate the Navajo Churro sheep, you know, and how to maintain the culture of it, but also how to learn to farm from how our grandparents farm and learn that ancestral knowledge. So it's really, I mean, a big conversation that we need to have, and also the exploration of it and sustainability of it, you know, is something now that we're questioning. And so when we talk about food access, it is still definitely a challenge, but we're definitely moving towards now that welcoming conversation, that it is an opportunity that we can all explore, that we can grow our own food, that yes, many families are now having gardens and revitalizing their farms and trading and, you know, going neighbor to neighbor and, you know, and trading, you know, different crops. And yes, you know, at our festivals and fairs, that we're able to now see more producers still bringing their corn and their squash and their pumpkins, you know. And yes, it is something, you know, that maybe we've never seen before, but also it's something that we've always, you know, had there in different areas of Navajo. So really that conversation is diverse, and it is very complex.
Well, but you're making such progress. I just want to wrap up with two things. First, if somebody were going to look at some websites to be able to learn more of these programs you're talking about, are there any in particular that you would, you know, recommend that people check out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for us, you know, Dene Community Advocacy Alliance, we
spell D-I-N-E.
D-I-N-E Advocacy, our handle is at Dine, which is D-I-N-E Advocacy. We're on Facebook. We share a lot of what the communities are doing and try to be the outlet to push the information. And I would also recommend that you check out Navajo Churro Land Presidium, the Sheep is Life program, and some other references that we have are also the farms that the Star Schools that we have on on the border in Arizona. And I would actually probably have to, like, you know, send you a list of all of these.
Oh, well, you can,
programs.
And we'll post them too.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the final thing I have for you, and I really, really appreciate your taking this time for this conversation, is I would like to have you end this in the Diné language. And if you were, and then somebody, and they're not going to understand what you're saying most for the most part, but if they want to play it back slowly and learn, they can figure out what it is you're saying to them. But if you're going to make a word of encouragement, feel free to give us a few sentences or whatever you can, but let's end in the language and leave that the mystery that people can figure out what it is you're saying.
Chian yat egi a inat e chian yat egi sha nijone chian yat egi a nanese aze et e ahihe.
Oh, that's great. You know what? This may be the first podcast of having the Diné language. And I really want to thank Denisa Livingston for being on Farm to Table Talk. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.